Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Congress passed and Donald Trump signed into law what he calls the One Big Beautiful Bill. It is a massive spending and tax bill that reshapes how states, including ours, deliver public aid, among other things. But the beauty of this bill will be lost on many as they experience some ugly consequences. North Carolina Governor Josh Stein predicts approximately 520,000 North Carolinians may lose their health care due to changes to Medicaid and to the Affordable Care Act marketplace, which helps people find affordable health insurance. The governor also says that as many as 670,000 people who gained access to Medicaid through its recent expansion may lose that access. And revisions to the SNAP, or Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, could leave 1.4 million without food assistance, over a half million of which are children. Those people are likely to have to turn to privately operated food banks, which may be unable to meet the needs. So this hour, we look at the possible consequences of this big, beautiful bill and that it will have on the lives of millions of North Carolinians and on the healthcare industry, on the food industry, and more. Melanie Bush is Assistant Secretary for North Carolina Medicaid at the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. She is here along with Michael Lays, Deputy Secretary for Opportunity and Well-Being at NCDHHS. And Heba Atwa is Director of Legislative Advocacy and Campaigns at the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center. That's a nonprofit, nonpartisan policy organization. Thank you all for being here. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So, Heba, I'm going to begin with you because both House Speaker Destin Hall and Senate Leader Phil Berger have praised this big, beautiful bill as one that roots out waste, fraud, and abuse, provides more money for immigration enforcement, and gives the middle class the largest tax cut in U.S. history. Much of that is debatable and a topic for another show, but U.S. Senator Tom Tillis voted against the bill, citing deep concerns over its impact on Medicaid funding to the tune of tens of millions of dollars. Tillis believes this bill will cost the state $26 billion over 10 years in the best-case scenario, $32 billion in the worst-case. Meanwhile, Speaker Hall says he is, quote, confident that we can implement the president's entire welfare reform agenda while maintaining Medicaid and SNAP. While Phil Berger's office last week said they were still evaluating the bill's impact and it would be premature to discuss any legislative action in response. So, from what we know about all this, the political pros and cons, the numbers, etc., which of the two, Mr. Hall or Mr. Berger, is more accurate in their assessment of this? Heba?
Well, I want to address a couple of things that you've mentioned. First, you asked about who might benefit from this bill and from HR 1. And so the folks from DHHS are certainly better positioned to talk about Medicaid and SNAP cuts. But I would say we know that those making upwards of $867,000, an average of $1.8 million a year, will receive a combined tax cut. This is in North Carolina, a combined tax cut of $3.6 billion in 2026. Meanwhile, as a result of the tax changes and the 2017 tax cut extensions in HR 1, those who make less than $25,000 a year would only get about $60 back, while losing the critical food assistance and healthcare support that the folks from DHHS will talk about and that you pointed to. Now, you also talk about whether or not we're prepared to absorb this cost shift. And as they'll tell you, it really is a cost shift. These programs that historically have been funded by the federal government, we will see a massive billions of dollars in a cost shift to our state. and we are not in a position to absorb those tax cuts. So a couple of those cuts. So a couple of things. The people of North Carolina are not in the position to, they're more vulnerable to these cuts because our General Assembly has been investing at historically low levels into the programs that North Carolinians say that they really want investments in. So they want to see a budget that invests adequately in public schools, an affordable childcare system, and the like. And instead, the General Assembly has been prioritizing tax cuts that disproportionately benefit corporations and the wealthy. We're talking about scheduled income tax rate reductions on the personal income tax side and a complete scheduled elimination of the corporate income tax that's costing us $8 to $18 billion and will cost us billions of dollars more a year. I know this isn't just me saying this. Our latest forecast, a consensus between the State Budget Office and the General Assembly's Fiscal Research Division, this comes out before every budget, so essentially lawmakers understand the amount of revenue that they're working with. The latest revenue forecast shows that we are headed for a structural imbalance, and this structural imbalance will create recurring deficits that will grow over time unless lawmakers change course. So that means that we will not have the money to invest the levels that we are now. And this is troubling because, as I mentioned, the General Assembly is investing at historically low rates. That's a 50-year low rate, given the size of our economy in North Carolina. So I would say we are not in a position to absorb this tax cut, these cuts, and this cost shift. And the people of North Carolina, given the low investments that our General Assembly has made into crucial programs and services that ensure well-being, people, individuals are also not in a position to.
So let's bring it down to those people, because you mentioned a second ago that the average tax cut for the lower income folks is about $60 a year, which is that right?
Yes, and
$60 a
that's
year?
from HR. Yeah, that's from HR1. We're talking about the federal tax cuts
Right.
now. Yes.
So, Melanie and Michael, since you work with both Medicaid and with the SNAP program, and I'll start with you first, Melanie. If you're a lower income person and you're getting that $60 tax cut under this new bill, but they're taking away or reducing access to Medicaid and SNAP, how much more are you likely to spend? Will you be able to get Medicaid? Will you without Medicaid, what will that do to your pocketbook, I guess is the question, Melanie.
Well, the way the Affordable Care Act is structured, individuals have to earn at least 100% of the federal poverty level to qualify for marketplace health insurance coverage. So if they don't have Medicaid and they are below 100% of the federal poverty level, there are no other options for them. They are uninsured. People who have income above 100% of the federal poverty level do qualify for subsidies on the marketplace and are able to receive coverage in that way. It was structured that way back when the bill was passed because it was just assumed that everyone would expand Medicaid. But of course, we had a Supreme Court decision that allowed states to opt out. And so for those states that do not have expansion in place, people between caregivers, for Medicaid, you have to be either aged, blind, disabled, a child, or a parent or caregiver to qualify without expansion. And the General Assembly has set the income limit for parents many years ago. It is now about 37% of the federal poverty level to be a parent to qualify for Medicaid. So everyone between 37% of poverty and 100% of poverty level would not have health insurance without expansion.
And Michael, since the people who are in the lower economic strata are going to be using SNAP benefits, many of them, not all of them, but many of them, and they're getting the $60 tax savings every year because of this bill, if you take away SNAP benefits, how much is that going to cost them?
Yeah, Mike, it's a great question. And one of the things leading up to the passage of this bill, and now as we're sort of digesting it since it's law, we are really underscoring the importance of the SNAP program and how critical it is to the 1.4 million North Carolinians who rely on this program for food assistance. So, and it's a lean program. This is a program that is just about less than $6 per person per day. So those are really critical benefits, and we want to underscore the importance of maintaining that program. And so there is some cost shifting, some significant cost shifting to the states that was included in that bill that we are concerned may risk us continuing the program in the state. And so this is something that is so important to those 1.4 million North Carolinians, but also the 600,000 children out of that 1.4 million that rely on the program. There's about 159,000 older North Carolinians who rely on that, about 46,000 veterans. So the program is critical, and we just want to ensure that that is kept top of mind as we look at some of these cost shifts that were included in the bill that will be trickling down to the states.
Melanie, North Carolina only recently came to the Medicaid game. They recently expanded Medicaid, the legislature did, and I think they added about 600,000 people to the rolls with that expansion. What has that meant for individuals for whom Medicaid was previously not available? And can you measure what the impact to the economy of that move has been? Yes, they now have access to health care, but that has helped the broader economy, has it not?
That's correct, Mike. We have, as of this morning, actually 677,000 North Carolinians that have received coverage through expansion. North Carolina Medicaid covers one out of every four people in the state that receive some sort of health care coverage through the Medicaid program. With the expansion, we are capturing people who previously did not have the option of coverage, as I mentioned, on the marketplace. So they have health care coverage for the first time in many years. We have individuals who have received prescription drugs, dental care for the first time in decades. We have seen folks getting treatment for substance use disorder, treatment for mental health issues. We have seen the impact to the state in general and the economy has been tremendous. It's reduced uncompensated care for our hospitals. We have reimbursement for providers and clinics that usually provided uncompensated care. We have also, as part of sort of the package for Medicaid expansion, the General Assembly passed a health care access stabilization program that is bringing $6 billion into our economy that is actually going to be severely impacted by HR 1. And we will lose that $6 billion to help our rural hospitals, to help our overall healthcare infrastructure, because they are reducing our ability to have state directed payments, and they are reducing our ability to use provider taxes to fund additional investment in healthcare. So this bill is really regressive in many ways to the overall economy, and taking out reimbursement for Medicaid from the economy is going to just drive everyone's health insurance costs up. Those are usually passed on to commercial insurers, and they make up the difference through increasing rates. So it's
was that truly, was that a motivation for this?
Was it a motivation for this? I really can't speak to what their motivation was. Okay. I think that they are really trying to change the way that the states have skin in the game. Yes.
We have to take a break. We'll come back. We have a lot more to talk about here. Melanie Bush is with us from NCDHHS, along with several others. We're coming right back.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte. Their curriculum aims to develop curiosity among middle schoolers and help them foster skills like critical thinking, collaboration, problem solving, and social awareness. More at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the impact of the One Big Beautiful Bill that was recently signed into law by the Trump administration, which has an impact on many things. And what we're talking about this morning is its impact on both Medicaid, access to and availability of Medicaid, and to the SNAP program, which is the food benefit program. Melanie Bush is the Assistant Secretary of North Carolina Medicaid at the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. Michael Lays is Deputy Secretary of Opportunity and Well-Being. They help run the SNAP program for DHHS. And Heba Athwa is with her. She's the Director of Legislative Advocacy and Campaigns with the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center. That's a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. And we were talking, Heba, a moment ago about the impact these cuts to Medicaid are likely to have, particularly on rural hospitals. And one of the reasons given by Republicans in the legislature who finally said, let's expand Medicaid, was because they were trying to save rural hospitals, many of which were cost burdened by patients who could not afford to pay for the care that they had to provide. And so this was going to help them. If you remove some of these Medicaid benefits from folks, don't we just reverse course and go back to where we were before? And what is the impact of that on rural hospitals, not just here, but around the country?
Well, Ms. Bush mentioned kind of this ripple effect that will be caused through the cuts of H.R. 1. On the SNAP side, less money for families buying food means less spending at local businesses. It's pretty clear that means that businesses in North Carolina could close, and there's an estimate that over 1,400 could. And we know that one in five rural hospitals in North Carolina is already at risk of shutting down. And, you know, in debate around this bill, there's been an outsized focus on the cost of anti-poverty programs, but no one is asking the vital question, what is the cost of poverty itself? What cost is paid when we do not address poverty? And we know that for an individual, not having enough to make ends meet takes years off of a person's life. And we know to our community and economy, it costs the economy through low productivity, not to mention the cost of addressing the symptoms of poverty itself. And the rhetoric around H.R. 1 fails to capture the reality of how we use the safety net. The rhetoric creates this false choice between an adequately funded safety net and contributions to the economy, which is false. People who use programs like SNAP and Medicaid and other fantastic programs like Head Start, they're not some class of perpetually poor. They are us. Some estimates put it at 60, and some estimates put it at 70% of Americans. So somewhere between 60 and 70% of Americans will rely on safety net programs at some point in their lives. And not only do safety net programs have a positive economic impact, but we know they work. And we know that because of the record low child poverty that was a result of the expansion of safety net programs during the pandemic era. And so we know that when the needs of people are prioritized, our economy does well. People and their well-being, not tax cuts, are the real drivers of economic growth. And we also know that businesses that provide good jobs, that financial security, want to be in a state that invests in well-being. Again, you can't buy a great school system, a healthcare system, food assistance for 1.4 million people, affordable and accessible childcare. You get my point. You can't buy any of that with tax cuts. You need public funding. You can't create a state infrastructure that's resilient in the face of natural disasters, stellar research infrastructure, with tax cuts. You need public funding, a tax code that provides adequate revenue equitably.
And the other thing that we know, as a result of the expansion of the availability of health care through the Affordable Care Act and through the expansion of Medicaid in this state and others, is that preventive medical care is cheaper than catastrophic health care, which comes as a result of not having that preventive care. I'm just curious, Melanie. Medicaid doesn't just allow low-income individuals to see a doctor when they get the sniffles. it allows for that preventive care. It allows them access to cancer treatments that would be unaffordable. So what will happen if people are in mid-treatment for some serious disease that they've been able to get treatment for because of Medicaid or because they have access to the Affordable Care Act when that is withdrawn?
People will continue to get sick, and that is something that we tried to impress upon our federal delegation and our state delegation, that regardless of the funding that is available, people continue to get sick and they will get worse without treatment. Of course, unfortunately, many people will die without appropriate medical care. It is a consequence of the lack of funding that they've put into this bill that we do anticipate that our state will get more unhealthy. North Carolina tends to be considered a healthy state overall, and we are considered to be an economically robust state overall. But when you have, 3 million North Carolinians who rely on Medicaid, potentially losing that coverage, they're going to get more unhealthy, and it's going to be reflected in our general economy and our general society.
Bottom line, is it going to cost us more to not make these benefits available than it is to make them available? That's the bottom line.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I 100% believe that.
Do our legislators not, do lawmakers not know this?
I would like to think that they do know this. I think they're focused more on a short-term 2-year cycle and, trying to stay elected rather than looking long-term. And that's
really
unfortunate.
Well, then why would you take coverage away from millions of people if you want to stay elected?
That's a very good question. And I think they're hoping that people will not notice or forget.
Mike, and a lot of these provisions in this bill don't kick in until after the midterm, so you're safe for at least 2 years in many cases. Michael, the governor says as many as 1.4 million North Carolinians could be left without food assistance because of revisions to the SNAP program. Talk about who is eligible for that program now, how that money for the program is used by these individuals who get it, and how it may change.
Absolutely, Mike. So this program, as you cited, 1.4 million North Carolinians rely on this, and this is generally lower income folks. This is older North Carolinians, this is folks, individuals with disabilities who qualify for this program. And it really is critical to their health. I just wanted to tie it back to, we know that healthy food access is critical to an individual's personal health and the health and well-being of their family. So there's absolutely a link there. One of the things in terms of the timing of the bill, you alluded to some of these, I would say, components come in a little bit later. So one of the key ones that is a couple years off, but something we still have to keep our eye on, is a significant cost shift that is coming to the states. And so the history of SNAP has been a fully federally funded benefit. So that's since the inception of the program. The feds have picked up the tab. And in North Carolina, that's $2.8 billion that's going out to SNAP participants to get that critical nutrition assistance. That is going to shift in this bill. And so it's tied to something that's a little bit technical, but it's called an error rate. So it's essentially how well states do in calculating benefits. And an error rate is determined based on overpayments or underpayments. Did a family get a little bit more than they were supposed to or a little bit less? That's calculated in each state, and then USDA does a national average. So that rate per state is going to be tied to how much we have to contribute as a state. So we have an error rate right now that was just released last month of 10.2%. And so there is kind of a tier system in terms of how much the cost share would be linked to that rate. That puts us in a 15% cost share if that math was done today. So 15% of $2.8 billion is $420 million, right? So that is a significant shift. We're obviously not the only state who is confronting a potential large cost share in a couple of years. So we want to ensure that, the importance of the program is kept at the forefront when we're thinking about the potential cost share in the future. But the bill has for the first time created this significant shift that has never existed in the program before.
Yeah, you mentioned that the federal government has funded the SNAP program 100% nationwide for 50 years since the inception of the program. And what is rarely talked about is that federal dollars coming into a state are dollars that are coming from every state into that state. And the blue states are richer. They're wealthier. They bring in more revenue, tax revenue, to the federal government and to their state governments than the red states. So isn't this going to hurt the red states, who will now have to make up the difference more than the blue states? And where do we fall in that? Because we're kind of purple.
Yeah, Mike, in terms of how it breaks down across the country, it's going to vary, right? It's going to vary on that rate that I mentioned. So the error rates vary across states. I will say our error rate is a little bit better than the national average. But to get down to an error rate where there's zero cost share, you'd have to get below 6%. And that's very difficult to achieve. In fact, only 8 states have achieved that as of last year. So 42 other states, including North Carolina, would be exposed to a significant cost share if we were using the current numbers.
And again, we tend to focus on the recipients and the money it's costing us to supply those recipients, whether it is with healthcare or food stamps or whatever it may be. We lose sight of the impact in the broader economy, which we've touched on a little bit here. But DHHS estimates that the state stands to lose $2.8 billion in annual federal funds. And those $2.8 billion generate $4.2 billion in economic impact. How so?
So Mike, you can think about the industries that would be impacted. So obviously, grocery stores, right? That's the first that comes to mind. But then you think about agriculture, right? That is helping to grow the food that is in those grocery stores. You can think about transportation, getting those products to the grocery stores so that they can be purchased by SNAP participants. We estimate that over 7,000 jobs in the state across some of those industries that I mentioned are supported by the SNAP economic benefit of $4.2 billion. And so it's a significant driver of our economy. It's very important also to small rural retailers who may be relying on those SNAP benefit purchases to really drive a significant part of their income. So undoubtedly, it's a significant driver of the North Carolina economy.
Yeah, but this is something that you talked about recently at a town hall meeting that you participated in, I believe, in Raleigh. These federal cuts are going to hurt the state. They're going to hurt people's well-being. They're going to hurt the economy. Is this going to be the case for most states? And if so, don't members of Congress, a lot of these states that these members of Congress come from are agricultural in nature. Don't they know this?
Well, as Ms. Bush mentioned, I can't speak to their intent or their motivation. What I can tell you is that North Carolina brought in an amount in federal funding equal to our state's entire general fund last year in 2024. So we very heavily rely on federal funding. And of course, that all of that money is not implicated in HR 1, but it's certainly something to consider with HR 1 and then also some of the funding freezes that we've seen across the board. You asked about state-level leaders. Are state-level leaders acknowledging the impact that this cost shift will have? I would say, again, I can't speak to their motivations or their intent, but I will say that I think that you can see through the budget process that we're in the middle of a little bit, you can get a little bit of insight into what each chamber is thinking. Now, right now in the budget process, the governor has put out a proposal early in spring. The Senate has voted on their proposal and the House has voted on their proposal. And now we are at the point in the process, a little late, one month into the next fiscal year, but we're in the part of the process where a conference committee is appointed. And those members negotiate a final budget proposal that will be voted on by the entire General Assembly. Now, if we look at each chamber's budget proposal, I think it tells us a lot. The Senate budget essentially disregards this cost shift that we've been talking about from these historically federally funded programs to now shifting a cost to North Carolina. And they do that by the Senate budget proposal actually does away with revenue thresholds. And these revenue thresholds were put into law essentially to prevent excessive tax cutting. So the Senate proposal would disregard those, charge ahead with the scheduled income tax rate reductions, both corporate and personal that I mentioned, and actually deepen tax cuts. They'd actually double down on the tax cuts and take the personal income tax to a low of 1.99, lower than what's in current law, 2.49. That's the rate at which it will end when fully phased in. Now, the House budget proposal takes a step towards fiscal responsibility, and they raise those revenue thresholds. So what that means is that essentially after falling to 3.99% next year, the personal income tax rate would likely remain, would pause at 3.99% through 2030. So I think that's an acknowledgement, essentially. Again, I can't speak to their intent or motivation, but I think that's an acknowledgement that lawmakers really are concerned about the fiscal position of North Carolina in general, and then also what this cost shift means for our state.
The budget for next fiscal year in North Carolina has not yet been decided because they went on break before they made that decision, and they're coming back to kind of reconcile this. And the argument is between Republicans.
We hope.
Yeah, well, the argument is among Republicans in the legislature. The Democrats are kind of not a part of this conversation because Republicans
Well, there are Democrats on the conference committee.
Yeah, but they...
Committee is bipartisan.
Okay, if you say so. But the Republicans run the place. So I guess my question is this. They left before the Big Beautiful Bill passed. So these two budget proposals, one from the House, one from the Senate, that don't take these cuts into consideration, in fairness, didn't need to because those cuts hadn't taken place. Now they have taken place. I hear the music, so we're coming to a break, so I'll give you a chance to think about this in the break. Because when we come back, I want to get an answer. When they come back, are they likely to make any major revisions to either of these bills and come to some agreement that will help them deal with these cuts that are coming down the pike? And we'll get an answer to that when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the impact in North Carolina of the One Big Beautiful Bill, particularly on SNAP and on Medicaid, access to Medicaid, with Melanie Bush, who is the Assistant Secretary for North Carolina's Medicaid Program at North Carolina DHHS. Michael Lays is Deputy Director of Opportunity and Well-Being. They oversee the SNAP program at DHHS. And Heba Atwa is Director of Legislative Advocacy and Campaigns for the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center, a nonpartisan nonprofit organization that analyzes various things. And I just asked you about these two budget bills that the General Assembly members will be coming back into session to deal with. Both of those bills, both of them were designed and passed prior to the enactment of the Big Beautiful Bill, which changes a lot. So when they come back, do you know of any plans for them to take those changes into consideration as they come to some sort of reconciliation on these two budget bills? Heba.
Great question, Mike. So before the break, we were talking about the difference, the key difference between the budget proposals. They seek to spend exactly the same amount, and they both do a lot of cutting to state programs. But on the tax side, the tax plans are different, a significant difference. And I mentioned the Senate plan doubles down on tax cutting, scheduling another rate decrease, and doing away with revenue thresholds that are supposed to prevent us from excessive tax cutting, whereas the House actually seeks, with increasing, through increasing the revenue thresholds, actually seeks to essentially pause the personal income tax rate reductions for a few years. So I see that as both an acknowledgement on the House side of this cost shift, that this is real and it really can harm the people and economy of North Carolina. And from what I hear, of course, the conference committee process is behind closed doors, but from what I hear, that is a key contention in the negotiations.
So I want to talk
So right now they've come back, as I understand it, to deal with some veto overrides, but we are sincerely hoping that soon they will take up that budget and they will do the fiscally responsible thing and they will pause both the personal income tax rate reductions and the corporate income tax rate reductions that, again, disproportionately benefit the wealthy. And I should mention that corporate income tax elimination, 9 out of every $10 flows out of our state.
Okay.
Not great for the state coffers or our economy.
I want to talk about some more of the fallout, both to the state and to individuals. Michael, because of inflation, because of rising grocery prices, food banks have already been operating at capacity. Kay Carter, who is the CEO of the Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina, locally here in the Charlotte area, told WFAE that these changes will result in people going hungry, and many of those people will be children and seniors because food banks don't have the bandwidth to pick up the difference. So the state faces a big decision. They could shift funds to cover this federal gap in funding for SNAP. They could reduce enrollment to lower costs, or they could completely withdraw, I'm told, from the SNAP program. What would those last two scenarios, withdrawing or reducing enrollment, look like for North Carolinians? Who would be most affected, and is there any real appetite for that among legislators?
Thanks, Mike, for the question. And so just on those two points you mentioned, in terms of enrollment, so the eligibility is largely driven at the federal level for SNAP. And so therefore, we don't have a lot of flexibility to limit that enrollment at the state in a meaningful way. And I would also add something to consider is because this program is an entitlement program, it can swing up and down based on economic trends, right? So we could see enrollment drive up if there was a slowdown in the economy. So there are some variables there, but just to underscore at the federal level, since they are driving the eligibility requirements for the most part, there is not a lot of opportunity for the state to change that number of overall enrollment. In terms of actually participating in the program or not, that would be something that is a potential concern if the state were not able to meet that significant cost share that I mentioned. In terms of our engagement with the legislature, we have talked a lot with legislators leading up to the passage of this bill. Immediately after the passage, we shared a briefing with them. I would say they're significantly engaged and do understand the importance of the program. So we're working closely with them in terms of ways that we can potentially drive down that error rate to get the cost share lower. But we all hope that the goal in the end is to ensure that the program exists because it's so needed. You mentioned the food banks who are doing incredible work across the state, but they absolutely are not prepared to take up the loss of a benefit that serves 1.4 million North Carolinians. And there's a striking stat that even with the benefit as it is today, we still have more than a million North Carolinians that are considered food insecure. And that's including 1 in 6 children. So that just underscores the importance of the program into the overall system that is supporting families and ensuring that they get the food benefits that they need that can't be picked up by our food bank partners.
Melanie, one of the stated reasons for this big, beautiful bill was to reduce fraud, waste, and abuse. And there are people who have said for years that people who are in the SNAP program and people who are on Medicaid are doing so even though they shouldn't be on those programs because they have the ability to work, they have a higher income than we think, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And supporters of these cuts also point to undocumented immigrants using Medicaid, something to which they are not entitled. Has this, in fact, been happening?
So we have an extensive program integrity infrastructure. We are audited at the state level. We are audited by the federal government. Our overall fraud, waste, and abuse is very, very small. By and large, it's not beneficiary driven either. It is by and large provider driven when you do have cases of fraud, waste, and abuse. We also do not serve undocumented immigrants except in emergency cases. And that is really a reimbursement requirement for hospitals because they have to provide care to anyone that shows up in an emergency room. So all of that rhetoric is really misleading. It's not true. It's not realized in the Medicaid program. I did want to follow up on changes you mentioned that are needed by the General Assembly. So the HR 1 actually implements, for the first time ever in the Medicaid program, work requirements to get at your point about people could be working and they're just not. Well, national data shows that 92% of Medicaid beneficiaries are working or are in school or are caregiving already. And so it's really that 8% of folks on the Medicaid program that can't work. They either don't have transportation for work or they may be disabled or they may be retired. And so they've implemented a significant administrative burden for our county DSSs, our Departments of Social Services, they're going to have to start administering these work requirements. Well, there's no funding. Well, there's $200 million at the federal level for all 50 states to implement these work requirements. We know already that our program is going to cost more than $200 million to implement because we have to buy the data that verifies income alone. That will skyrocket our contract for that. We're also having to do this every 6 months. We're doing eligibility redeterminations every 6 months and work requirements every 6 months for roughly 700,000 folks. North Carolina has a trigger law that says that we cannot spend any state funding on Medicaid expansion. These work requirements are related to Medicaid expansion. So we need the North Carolina General Assembly to take action to either change the trigger law to allow for state funding for these work requirements, or to come up with another mechanism for funding for these work requirements, or 677,000 people will lose their health insurance coverage because we will not be in compliance with the federal law.
Is that likely to happen?
It remains to be seen. I hope not. I've spent many years now trying to get Medicaid expanded in this state, but it really comes down to whether or not they have the votes to change the law, whether or not they have the willingness to provide state funds when there's so much other cost shifting going on, or whether or not they can find another mechanism to fund the work requirements.
You mentioned that this is a big burden on this state and others. Some have called this an undue burden. Under these new federal guidelines, though, starting in January of 2027, so there is some time here, adults 19 to 64 will have to complete 80 hours of work per month and be part of this, have to face redetermination on whether they're eligible for this every 6 months going forward. Right. For people who are seriously ill and receiving Medicaid because they need that money for treatment, how do you determine whether they are able to meet those work requirements?
Well, that's a great question, and it's something that we've tried to impress upon folks. There are exemptions for people who are complex medical conditions, chronic conditions, et cetera, but we don't have that data necessarily in our eligibility system. So we're going to have to figure out a way to get that information, and then we will have to have caseworkers verify that information. There's not a database, for example, of people who are ill. There's not a database of people who are in school. There's not a database of people who are in, doing community service. Well, so what this is going to require, it's going to require the actual beneficiary to provide proof of verification to a local county DSS. And that administrative burden could potentially cause people to not continue to be eligible because they miss deadlines or they don't provide the right information.
Well, you and others have said that, my head's going to explode this morning, but you and others have said that you just talked about not having data. And you and others, here's the question. You and others have said, I really can't come up with a question. I can't do it. My brain will not cooperate this morning. I'm sorry. I'll come back to it. Under these new federal guidelines, Michael, outlined in this big, beautiful bill, SNAP recipients from 18 to 64 will also have to work 80 hours per month. And veterans and homeless people who are will no longer be exempt from those work requirements. How is that likely to affect those recipients?
So, Mike, SNAP already had work requirements in place for able-bodied adults without dependents, but you're exactly right. The age threshold has been extended. So it previously was 18 to 54. That goes up to 18 to 64, as well as able-bodied adults who are parents of children over 14. And the exemptions that were previously in existence to some of those work requirements, several have been removed. You mentioned individuals experiencing homelessness, children aging out of foster care, and veterans. And so those are things that we are tracking closely to see what kind of impact. We have seen some national estimates that that would subject about 90,000 more folks in our state to work requirements, therefore putting them at risk of potentially losing some of those benefits. And I will mention one thing. In terms of timing, this is not in effect yet. We are still waiting for final guidance from USDA in terms of when that's implemented. I just want to clarify that for the listeners.
So I now have the question, Melanie. I didn't eat my Wheaties this morning, so I'm cognitively not here yet. So anyway, you and others have said that it is providers who are guilty most often of any kind of fraud, waste, or abuse. It is not the recipients of these Medicaid funds. Right. It is the doctors and hospital systems who are defrauding, not that. So without the data that you need on figuring out who is eligible and who is not, how do you know you're not being defrauded by the recipients? How do you know that we have able-bodied people who are getting these Medicaid funds who could work but don't? How do you know?
Well, it remains to be seen. CMS is going to issue guidance in June of 2026 that will tell us what counts as verification, because we don't know necessarily
how to verify this. Do you know that most of the fraud is coming from providers and not recipients?
Oh, because we have audits and we have records and we have proof, by and large, that most of the fraud that happens in the Medicaid program is driven by providers. It's a very small number of beneficiaries. And usually in those cases, if someone is receiving Medicaid coverage, it's either a caseworker error or someone just had information wrong. It's not intentional. It is simply a reporting error. You have to be incredibly, incredibly limited in Medicaid eligibility is very restrictive. You have to have very low income. And we do have ways of verifying that information automatically. But to your point, with all these exemptions from work requirements, it's going to be, by and large, a very manual process.
Medicaid work requirements don't change till January 1st, 2027. Medicaid cost sharing, where states must impose deductibles or co-pays for enrollees, begins October 1st, 2028. Both dates are beyond the midterms. Some say that that is to hide the impact until after the midterms to benefit Republicans. But if Republicans should lose the House or the Senate or both, would these delayed start times allow Democrats to roll back these changes before they go into effect, Heba? And I have about a minute left.
I think it depends. And we speak at NC Budget and Tax Center about policy, not politics. But what I will tell you is that our state lawmakers must invest the resources necessary to protect these vital programs. We've heard from the DHHS folks, we could actually see them go away. That's horrible for individuals, for our communities, for our economy, and they need to do so without eliminating or cutting vital state-funded programs.
And with that, we have to stop. Heba Atwa is Director of Legislative Advocacy and Campaigns for the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. Melanie Bush is Assistant Secretary of the North Carolina Medicaid Program with DHHS. And Michael Lays is Deputy Secretary of Opportunity and Well-Being. They oversee the SNAP program for DHHS. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.